It's kind of a perfect rainy morning to tell us all a story. Recently, I had an opportunity to reread or review Dogen Zenji. Dogen was the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, and he wrote a lot of stuff, some of which is even understandable. And this is one of the more understandable bits. But he wrote a fascicle about the officers of a monastery. And it sounds like it might be kind of boring, but actually it has a lot to tell us about how we live our lives, what it means to mature in practice, and what it means to take responsibility for ourselves and our practice and the world. So the officers in a monastery are responsible for supporting the practice of the place. So that includes all aspects, right? Includes everything from teaching people how to do meditation to clean, making sure that the toilets are cleaned and the paths are swept and the books are kept. It's the whole range of activities that support the environment of practice. So there's a director, there's a financial officer, there's a head of a meditation hall. These are all probably very familiar to you. Yeah. So the key aspect of an officer is that they step forward and are willing to engage in supporting community life. So if we think of this, if we think of the monastery as the place in which we practice, right, which is this building, it is our home, it is our job, it is how we drive down the street, it is the grocery store, it is the world, then we can see these instructions as instructions to how to engage with every aspect of our practice and every aspect of our lives. And when we step up and take responsibility in any dimension of our lives, we become, so to speak, officers of the monastery in the widest possible sense. So the first thing that Dogen tells us is that an officer is precious and venerable. Precious and venerable. So every time we take responsibility, we are awake in that moment. We are precious and venerable. And by taking responsibility, what I mean is that we shift our center of gravity from self-preoccupation to the center of the situation. So we don't abandon our own needs or desires or wants or aspects, but we include everything. So we look at the whole situation and say, what needs to happen here? Yeah, I've got something I have to do, but the bathroom needs to be cleaned here. Or, you know what I mean, or something's happening at work. This is where we look at the whole situation. We say, what is the most compassionate response? Where is awakening here? So we meld with the world in a way without losing who we are. And it's this happens in very concrete ways. It's not some kind of like global, I'm going to be something special kind of thing. It's really taking our place in that moment. So Dogen tells us that in terms of selecting officers, they should be mature in the way. That's what he says. Officers should be mature in the way. And you think, oh boy, you know, that excludes me, right? But then, of course, Dogen completely contradicts himself, as he's wont to do. And he gives us an example. And this is the story that I want to tell you. So Nanda, not Ananda, but Nanda. This is the story of Nanda. And Nanda is basically clueless. So Nanda is a prince. Well, first of all, let me say, if you think of this as a parable, so this is a teaching story, okay? And we can look at the various aspects, and we can try on different ways of understanding them. And then they help illuminate. So I'm going to make some jumps here, and you may or may not make them with me, but that's okay. So each of us can relate to Nanda in his search. Yeah? Nanda, I'll tell you his story in a minute, but Nanda's looking for something. So I think we can all relate to that. And he's in relationship with the Buddha. And we can relate to this. One way of relating to the Buddha is that part of our human experience. It's just kind of makes me a little uncomfortable to say this, but I'll say it anyway. Is that part of our human experience that leads us to realization. So what Suzuki Roshi called our inmost request. Okay? Prods us, requires us, challenges us. There's a kind of trickster quality to this dimension of our human experience. As we'll see, Nanda got more than he bargained for when he started relating to Buddha. So Nanda starts off, he's a prince. He's a person of privilege. He's comfortable, like us. He starts off comfortably in his house. And then Buddha informs Nanda that it's time for him to receive the precepts. So let me read you this little story. This is from the Tathagatagarbha Sutta, if any of you know this. When the world honored one, that's Buddha, was in the city of Kapilavastu, he informed Nanda by visiting him and shedding light in his house that the time for him to receive the precepts was at hand. Nanda thought, this must be the world honored one. He sent someone to look, and sure enough, it was the world-honored one. Nanda wanted to see for himself. Okay? His wife thought, if I let him go out and look, he will suddenly be moved to leave the household. So she tugged on his robe, and Nanda said, I'll be right back. She said, please come back before my makeup dries. Nanda says, of course I will. So, we can think about this first part of the story is how often we begin. This is how we begin. Something sparks our interest, right? Something's not quite right. You know, dukkha, right? So we pursue the teachings. We want to know our true nature. We want to know something. We want to see for ourselves. I'll be right back, he says. We think we can just step out of our home, our comfortable identity, the way we understand ourselves. We'll be back in a moment. We'll just go out there and see kind of what the Buddha has to offer, but we'll be home. We'll be back to our comfortable notions about who we are. But something else happens. So notice that Nanda is stepping out of what's comfortable. He's stepping out. He's leaving. Something's happened there. Something sparked his interest. But he still has this idea that nothing's really going to change. It's really going to be okay. He can come home and be safe again. So he's essentially clueless about what's going to happen to him. Have any of you ever felt that way? No? You come to practice and you think, oh, everything's going to be so great. I'm going to be so comfortable. My mind will be serene. It doesn't usually work that way. So, Nanda finds a Buddha. And the Buddha handed Nanda his bowl and asked Nanda to serve him rice with it. When Nanda came back with the rice, the Buddha was gone. So Nanda offered it to Ananda, right? Buddha's attendant. Ananda said, who gave you this bowl? And Nanda said, the Buddha did. Then Ananda said, then you should go and give it to the Buddha. So Nanda went away and found the Buddha and offered him the bowl. Buddha asked a disciple to shave Nanda's head. Nanda said to the disciple, you can't hold a razor to the head of a prince of Jambavipa. But he also thought, even though I obey the world-honored one in the morning, I can go home in the evening. Buddha understood his thought and transformed the place where Nanda stood into a deep pit so that he was unable to return home. Isn't this great? So, Nanda responds to Buddha's request for an offering, a simple act of giving, right? This is what happens when we listen to that which to our inmost request. Something is required of us, some piece of generosity, some action, some giving. So Buddha asked for a simple act of giving and of nourishment. When Nanda can't find Buddha, he tries to give it to somebody else. Can we see this? It's like, okay, I'm going to give this, but it really doesn't matter if it's my true innermost request. I can just give it to anybody. You know, I'll just do it. But it doesn't work. Ananda says, no, you have to offer it to the Buddha. You got started. You have to give what you have to give to the Buddha. You can't get away with substitutes. So we have to understand Buddha, you know, as our deepest intention for wisdom, to wake up. No substitutes. So poor hapless Nanda ends up with the Buddha, and then someone is shaving his head before he knows it. This was definitely not in the plan. Right? I mean, he thinks he's going to go back home again, and then he finds, and his self rears up. How dare you? How dare you shave the head of a prince? So if we think of this metaphorically, what's asked of us is renunciation. This is head shaving, right? It's not literal. It's like in our lives, in our daily lives, over and over again, we're asked to let go of who we think we are. All of the stuff that we put on. We're asked to let go of that, to show up naked to this moment. So, Nanda's basically saying, don't you know who I am? This one? I am a prince. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. So it happens anyway. The renunciation happens anyway. Nanda does take the leap. He may be kind of sucked backwards into it, but he does take it. But he still thinks he can control the process. He still thinks he's going to be able to go home again. You know, he'll let his hair grow out. You know, he'll go home, put his feet up, turn on the television. You know, everything will be back to normal. But the Buddha knows that this is impossible. You know, when we take that leap, we can't go back again. We can only go forward. You know? Which doesn't mean that it's some kind of a relentless, grueling journey. But it is moving forward. It is a commitment to waking up. It's impossible to turn back. The Buddha understood his thought. Our inmost request knows what monkey business we get up to, right? All the stuff we concoct, all the ways in which we turn practice into this or that or the other, and what we want and don't want. And it really... doesn't allow that. So, Buddha understood his thought and transformed the place where Nanda stood into a deep pit so that he was unable to return home. Have you ever felt that way? Have you ever come to a sitting and felt like you were in a deep pit? No? I have. Or that somehow you were shedding things and you couldn't quite pit it, you know, like Humpty Dumpty. This isn't necessarily a negative experience, but it can be. The point is, it's kind of like, you know, the valves in your blood vessels, you know? They open up and whoosh, and then they close and you stop. Whoosh. like that. So there's Nanda, stuck in a pit with his head shaved. And he can't go back. And what does Buddha do? Buddha makes him an officer. So here's this poor hapless dude. And now he's got to take responsibility for running the monastery. I mean, he didn't even want to get into this mess to begin with. So earlier Dogen said that people who were officers were chosen for their maturity in the way. And this guy has stumbled along into ordination, renunciation. Doesn't even know what an officer does. And Buddha's asking him to take responsibility from the beginning. And I think this is often the experience that we're in. We don't know what we're doing, but we know our intention. So we take responsibility from the beginning, even when we don't know how. We show up, we have curiosity, we listen to the situation. We want to respond. We engage in a certain way. That in that way, caring for the monastery, it's not about how well you do it or whether it's perfect and everything's nice and tidy. It's the act itself of engaging. So, despite everything, Nanda is willing. So, Buddha said to Nanda, make Nanda an officer. Ananda conveyed Buddha's word to Nanda. Nanda said, what is an officer? And Ananda said, that's a job of taking responsibility in a temple. Nanda said, what kind of work is it? Ananda said, after the monks go begging, you sweep the garden, sprinkle water, collect firewood, remove cow dung, cleanse the space, make sure that things are not taken, close the gates and doors, and such for the Sangha. In the evening, you open up the gates and clean the toilets. Okay? Not glamorous work. Okay. When this conversation was over, the monks went out to beg. Nanda went to close the gates for the Sangha. When he closed the gate in the west, the gate in the east flapped open. When he closed the gate in the east, the gate in the west opened. And this went on and on. Nanda said to himself, if something is stolen, then in the future, when I become a king and build hundreds and thousands of beautiful temples, that should be more than enough to compensate for any loss. So he went home. It's like, enough of this. So we can imagine Nanda running back and forth, right? He's trying to close this gate, he's trying to close the other gate. He's worried about things being stolen. He's frustrated. He's confused. You know, can you relate to that? I just started being the clinical director for a new counseling program. Somebody asked me to do this, and in my, like, Nanda, I was like, okay. I relate to Nanda a lot. You know, somebody says to me, where should we put this wall? I'm like, I don't know. I know nothing about walls. You know, what telephone system should we get? It's like, I haven't a clue. One that works, you know? It's like that. It's very much like, okay, the west, the door in the east, in the west, and then, you know, like that. But there's something alive about our intention and Nanda's intention, right? But he's still fooled thinking that things that he has to do his job in a certain way, that everything, that the gates have to close and everything has to be done, like life is controllable. And what this situation is doing is it's really showing him, no. The practice happens in the midst of, as Pema would say, groundlessness. When things are really wacky, you show up. You give what you have to give. Right? We don't have to get caught in this tense, frightened, everything's got to be taken care of. But Nanda's response to this kind of gates flying open is that in the future, notice, in the future when he has complete control, when he's rich, he's going to compensate for everything and everything will be okay. He's projecting into the future when he has power, when he has all that he thinks he needs to have. So he will make up for the present in the future. which, as we all know, is not possible and not really a good idea. So we think, like Nanda, sometime in the future I'll be more powerful, I'll know more about where what telephone system to order, or how to relate to this person and this job, and now I have a new one. You know, I'll know, but everything will be okay at some point. We look for this peace and stability. But when we do that, we miss the opportunity of the practice right there. So I wish for Nanda and for myself and for all of us that we stop and appreciate the wind as it blows through the gates. You know, the feel of your feet on the earth. You know, what is the experience of being there in that moment, totally awake, mindful of what's going on? This is where we come alive, yeah? Not in some future time when we have it all together. But Nanda's trying, and he's discouraged. And he thinks, okay, I'll get it together in the future. But for now, I'm going home. Now listen to this part. Fearful that he would run into the Buddha if he took the main road, he took a back road. Okay, like, I just can't face my own intention. I can't face my, you know, what I've said I'm going to do. I'm just going to kind of sneak home. He hid himself in a bush. But when the wind blew, his body was revealed. And Buddha said, "What are you doing here?" And Nanda replied, "I am worried about my wife." So he lied, right? So he's fearful. He's caught in a fear sense of, I should be doing it this way, I should be doing it that way. He's not awake to what's actually going on. And he's sneaking home, trying to hide from his obligations, his inmost intention. Hiding behind a bush. But then, as always happens, the wind blows, something happens, and we are revealed. Or at least if it happens, if we're lucky. And the Buddha says, "What are you doing here? What are you doing here?" You know, our deepest intention says, "What are you up to? What are you doing right now? What are you doing?" And Nanda, like, thinks he can get away with saying, "Oh, I'm worried about somebody else. I'm concerned about my wife." Now, what Nanda doesn't know is the Buddha is filled with compassion. Yeah. Buddha is not going to condemn him or be harsh with him. Nanda is human in that moment. He's frightened. He's nervous. He wants to go home. He can't say, "I'm afraid, I'm uncomfortable, I don't want to be here, I don't like this. This is not what I signed up for." He's hiding even from himself. He's hoping that the Buddha will buy it, right? But the Buddha sees right through this cop-out. You know, he knows exactly what's going on. So, you know, this inmost request, our deepest intention, really sees through all the smoke screens that we put up and recalls us back to what it really means to be alive. But the Buddha responds to Nanda, where Nanda is. And the story goes on for a long time, but basically, Buddha puts Nanda in the seam of his robe. And then he proceeds to fly around and show Nanda various dimensions of human life. Yeah? He's carrying him and pushing him to look around and see. And Nanda, through relying on this inmost intention, being willing to be carried by this deep affinity, comes to understand that he really does want to do the work of practice. But it doesn't happen out of harshness. It happens out of growing close to our deepest nature and allowing ourselves to be led by what is most important to us. So we look deeply and see what's there and follow. In the end, Nanda develops a practice that's free from the notions that so confused him. You know, he really kind of gets it. So Dogen praises Nanda at the end of this fascicle, saying that his precedent of realizing the way should be revered and longed for. Okay? His precedent of realizing the way should be revered and longed for. He uses this example as the first piece of writing that he does about the officers. So the first example he uses of what an officer is this kind of bumbling, struggling person. He doesn't use as his first example this kind of stellar person who kind of comes in and all gates stay closed and the food's perfect and everything's, you know, it's really speaking to us as we continually learn what our practice is and how it fits into our lives and how do we take responsibility in this situation? How do we come forward in this situation? How do we sit still? When we're sitting and our mind becomes confused and struggling, and we return and we have ideas about how it should be, or when we're in relationship with another being or a physical being, you know, how do we actually encounter that over and over again and take Nanda as our example so that we work to stay close to Buddha's truth. We know that when we forget, not if we forget, but when we forget, by coming back to our intention, we will be carried, in a sense, back to our awareness. So we stay awake to these questions. And this is maturity. It's not just gets us to maturity. This is maturity. Being willing to be in the mix and be open to these kinds of questions and listening to our inmost request is awakening. There is a quality of stillness about this. Yeah? Does that make sense to you? Quality of stillness. And when I was thinking about that stillness, I remembered a very favorite part of a poem. So I hope this relates to you. It does to me. And it's about the kind of stillness that we carry into activity when we're willing to continue to ask these questions. When we're continuing to ask, how does our inmost request, what is required of us now? This is by T.S. Eliot. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown, remembered gate, when the last of earth left to discover is that which was the beginning. At the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard, in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick, now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, and all manner of thing shall be well. This is what Ananda is discovering, yeah? We don't have to hang on to these notions of fixing everything and making it all. But listening to our own presence and being awake. We have about 10 minutes. Are there any questions that you'd like to ask? Yes.
What were some of the practices that the Buddha shared with Nanda?
Nanda?
Yeah.
Oh, he took him all over. Let's see, where did he fly him to? He flew him to the 33rd heaven and showed him around. Took him to a pleasure park. Let's see. Well, they went back to Jetta Grove and talked to him about the community of monks and how to relate to the community of monks. Took him to various hells. So he took him all over. Basically showed him what the way I would describe this is he showed him the full range of our human experience. Everything from celestial bliss to the agony of hell.
Is there any reference to what the Buddha recommended in terms of awareness practice that Ananda would engage in? Any particular mindfulness of the breath, jhana, jhana concentration? Anything referencing that?
He doesn't talk about that. But you have to remember, this is written. This was lifted from the Tathagata Garbha Sutra. By Dogen. So Dogen's going to say zazen, 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 right? Zazen, zazen, zazen. But we can understand that the Buddha is teaching awareness practice, in the multiple ways that we can do that. We can do it in seated mindfulness meditation. We can do it walking. We can do it washing dishes. We can do it driving. We can do it listening to a coworker at work. There's no end to the forms of our practice. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. If I wanted to go back and read Dogen's writing, the story of the Buddha, and the poem, where would I go? Three references.
Oh, goodness.
Thanks for asking the question, because maybe I should be asking more of a question about you and your practice. But
well, that's fine. You can ask me whatever you want. Let's see, I think that this fascicle is, this particular one, probably in the Eheshingi, Rules for the Monastic Community, Taigen Leighton, and Shohaku Okamura. But it might be someone else, somewhere else, this particular story. So, Shingi, S-H-I-N-G-I, Shingi, Ehe for Ehe Dogen. What was the other question? T.S. Eliot, Four Quartets. Four Quartets. That's the Four Quartets.
Oh,
yeah.
And the, then the, I guess the, if I wanted to read the story, the Buddha story that Dogen's referring to, the story of Nanda.
Oh, it's in the Tathagatagarbha Sutra. Let's see. That might be a little harder to find. Some of the Tathagatagarbha literature is not so easily accessible in like big hunks, but you can search for it.
Mm-hmm. I really like the story of Nanda. I liked your personal illustration of being put in charge of something and not knowing how to do it. Like, what kind of phone system should we get? And I mean, I feel that way. I imagine most people do. That a lot of times when you work in the world, there's sort of a tension between if you're starting to practice and you're trying to become aware of that deepest intention, but your encounters with the world where you're constantly put in situations where you don't feel like you know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel that at work and relationships. I feel that being in charge of my own life.
Uh-huh.
Like,
yeah.
Who the hell knows how to run this? And then what I really relate to Nanda's like running away, just slipping away. Because I mean, I act that out all the time. I go, I don't want to be this conscious.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to be this aware. I don't want to try to be present. Like,
uh-huh.
Slippery
devil.
Pema says,
we?
I don't want to sit
slippery.
Here groundless. I want to get established somewhere
yeah.
where I know. I wonder how you wrestle with that. I mean, you have to say. Well, we'll get this kind of phone system,
uh-huh.
or I'll find somebody who knows about phone
yeah.
systems, and you have to do that without getting defensive or solid or concrete or whatever.
This is where my Zen training came in real handy, because in a Zen, at least when I was at Tassajara, a lot of times, if you didn't know how to do something, that's the job you would get. So you don't know how to cook, you're the Tenzo, you know, and you got to figure it out. And part of what you figure out is what one of my teachers said, do your best and then apologize. Which doesn't mean, oh, I'm this horrible person. It means, you know, you show up, you do your best, and things get bumpy. But that's life. You know, that's how we meet one another. And it appears to be a hard-won skill, you know, really, for us to just get it. That things don't mesh, you know? And we have to be willing to be there. And this is what Suzuki Roshi calls beginner's mind, and what Pema calls practicing with groundlessness. You know, it's all this. When I was a kid, I had a horse, and I got thrown every day for a year. And I realized later on in doing Zen practice, I thought, oh, it's the same thing. You have to learn to fly in the air, you know? You have to learn to turn your shoulder and land and get up and deal with the situation because you're 4 miles from home and your horse is just like across the pasture. You know, it's like that's what you do, is we learn flexibility, and we learn humility, 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 humility. Thomas Merton says humility is being completely who you are. Isn't that great? So it's not about humility like, oh, collapse. And it's not defended like, I didn't do anything wrong. I know all about telephone systems. You know, it's more that being in relationship and being very curious and open and practicing awareness. That's what we're doing. We're practicing awareness, compassionate awareness, with all of the elements of the situation, and acting for the benefit of everyone concerned to the best of our ability. And then, you know, something happens, and you say, well, I thought that was going to cost $500. It's $2,000? Okay. It's like that. Beginner's mind. Thank you all very much.